All right, hello everybody, and welcome to Moms Fighting Autism. You've tuned in to our third annual Autism Conference. We're very happy you're here with us today. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernotitis. A little bit of housekeeping here before we begin. If you're listening in via the internet, you can go to the blue box on your screen and click slides when it's time to view the slideshow. I do realize we're having a little issue with our link, so bear with us. We are working on it. Just keep trying to access that the webinar page, and I'm sure it will eventually be fixed. They're working hard on it. You can synchronize your slides with either your phone or the webcast audio by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. Make sure you mute your computer if you're listening via the phone so you don't get an echo. Telephone users can ask a live question at the end by pressing star 2 to raise your hand, and that alerts me that you have a question. So today we're talking with Dr. Josh Fader about diagnostic confusion, comorbidity in the broad spectrum ASD. I want to tell you a little bit about Dr. Fader. He's the director of the Department of Research in the Graduate School of the Interdisciplinary Council on Developmental and Learning Disorders, and a voluntary assistant professor at UCSD School of Medicine. Dr. Fader specializes in neurobehavioral medicine and application of DIR floor time with families and in schools. He co-chairs the DIR Floor Time Coalition of California and co-chairs the South County's Autism Regional Task Force of the California Senate Select Committee on Autism and Related Disorders. Dr. Fader helped write the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Practice Parameter for Assessment and Treatment of Autism and Related Disorders. He reviews grants for the Organization for Autism Research, OAR, and the National Foundation for Autism Research. He is a primary clinical investigator for the National Institute of Mental Health and privately funded research in pharmacogenetics. You'll fix that later, with the Child and Adolescent Psychiatric Trials Network. Dr. Fader serves as medical director for SimPlay, developing interactive technology and distance learning systems to support relationship-based interventions. He is involved in advocacy for family choice in evidence-based practice, and he is a frequent commentator and speaker for Valerie's List and for Autism College. Dr. Fader has a full-time child and family psychiatric practice in Solana Beach, California. Boy, did I butcher that, Dr. Fader, or what?
It's fine, Nancy. Thank you so much.
Okay, pharmacogenetics. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, that's the study of how drugs work, and can we look at the genetics involved and whether drugs are effective or whether people are having side effects. And I may mention a little bit about that later in the talk or not. We have
okay,
time.
Good.
Shall I take it away?
You can take it away.
Well, thanks so much, Nancy. It's great to be here again this year. If you see the slide, I changed the title a little bit to Broad Spectrum ASD, What's the Diagnosis, What Should We Do, to try to tone down what I'd like to talk about over the next hour and a quarter or maybe up to an hour and a half. We'll try to leave some time for questions. So as Nancy said, I am director of research at ICDL and an assistant clinical professor at UCSD School of Medicine. On slide 5 here, you can see my disclosures. Doctors are supposed to tell you where they're paid so you can better understand how much you want to believe what they're telling you. In fact, any practitioner should tell you that. And I figured I'd do a graphic to show you because there's just way too many things that I'm doing. The main thing, that big yellow egg, is what I do for most of my income. I play on the floor with kids, or I sit talking to people, or I do assessments in my office. It's really, really fun. If you drew a line to the horizontal on this slide in the middle, you'd see the things that pay me and then the things at the bottom that I pay into in cost order. So at the top, ICDL research, I do get about 10% of my income working for ICDL in the graduate school, teaching courses in biostatistics, in pharmacology, pharmacogenetics, things like that, and doing research. Actually, I just put a new paper into autism this week on engagement and circles of interaction. You can't see it in these slides. I could see it when I made the PowerPoint, but between that one and the other blue one, there should be a mark that shows three waves like an ocean. It's important because we do training in Floratime here in Southern California, and that's where I also derive some of my income. After that is CAPTAIN, that's the NIH work that I do in pharmacogenetics. Bridge Collaborative, that's research through Rady Children's Hospital and UCSD on early intervention with toddlers and infants who we find to be possibly at risk for autism and related disorders. Pfizer Pharmaceuticals hasn't paid me yet, but they owe me, for similar research in pharmacogenetics. Moms Fighting Autism is sponsoring this talk today for me to be here. Now we get to the part where I pay out, CircleStretch.com, that's Circle. These slides and probably an audio of this will be posted on CircleStretch sometime in the next week. CircleStretch is a community access website with lots of free stuff. CircleStretch.com is just our place where we park all my stuff and my community's things for you to use. Vine Engineering below that is for kids to develop their engineering skills. It's a personal interest of mine. Cherry Crisp is that cherry that you see. In fact, today's talk is made possible by the Chicken Soup Division of Cherry Crisp Entertainment and Productions, home of Home Ec with Karen and Company, and always open even during Passover. Without that chicken soup, I would not be here this moment. DIR Floratime Coalition of California is the advocacy group that helps press for parent choice in California and throughout the country. Parent choice meaning families will get the choice of what things they want to do with their kids to try to help them out. And I'm going to talk about evidence-based practice in a little bit. You'll understand more what I'm talking about. And finally, the thing that sinks most of my hobby time and money is SimPlay Family Games for Autism. Everybody's got an app for autism. Well, I'm developing one too with some friends. And it's a lot of fun, a lot of work, and we're going to try to make it so that these games don't just hypnotize your children, but are fun, fun for you to play with them and actually encourage face-to-face interaction. So stay tuned for that. I want to give a pitch for Moms Fighting Autism. If you've been listening to these talks, you'll realize that Moms Fighting Autism gets high-quality speakers. They provide these talks for everybody anywhere around the world. It's an amazing, amazing organization, and I really encourage you to donate to this organization or join the Spectrum Gold Club, which would give you access to all the talks on the website, all the talks that have been given. I think it's $1 a month for the first month, and then about, I don't know, $29 a month after that. You can also buy a set of this conference. I forget exactly how much that is, but you can go to the website and find out. It's a very worthwhile organization to donate to. You can get some really good stuff. Maybe listen to some of these talks in the car on the way to work or on the subway or something. Well, my outline for today, which I'll repeat throughout the talk, is a little complicated. Starts with some vignettes of the typical kinds of cases that run through my practice, how usual diagnosis, without thinking about ASD, often drives care decisions, how when we dig deeper, we find in some of these cases where people have an autism spectrum disorder that explains a lot of how someone got where they are now. I'll talk about understanding evidence-based practice in autism spectrum disorders and spend some fun time with you looking at differential diagnosis and multiple diagnostic considerations. We've got an autism spectrum disorder and some other diagnosable neurobehavioral or psychiatric condition. We'll talk a little bit about maturational and developmental considerations because different things look differently at different ages. We'll talk a little bit about family systems and other complex systems aspects of these situations. I want to talk a little bit about the DSM, the Official Diagnostic Manual for Psychiatric Disorders, and the DMIC, which is a different version of a similar kind of process that may explain things a little bit more. And finally, I want to spend some time talking about what do we do about all this? How do we plan or move forward in a reasonable way? And I'll make a pitch for reflective process. Within this talk, there are three big ideas that I want to highlight about how we can improve what we know and figure out what to do. Evidence-based practice, which is really important for you to understand. Crowdsourcing, which is really fun to do and important to understand. And finally, reflective practice, which is what we all should be doing, parents, providers, even kids, to be able to move forward in a reasonable way. So, vignettes, four typical cases. An adult might come into my office with compulsive substance use, alcohol, marijuana, other kinds of things. Maybe has trouble on the job or trouble keeping a job, might have very few friends, may be very discouraged with his or her life. An adolescent might come into my office who was inappropriate with a young girl he was babysitting. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along. Not that every adolescent who walks into my office has done things like that, but this is sort of a dramatic way to highlight issues in adolescence, issues surrounding ASD. So you'll understand as I move forward. Well, I often get a third grader or someone about that age who's tantruming when asked to read a chapter book or do other kinds of work, has a lot of trips to the office, and then gets sent home for the day as a reward. And then finally, we've got a lot of preschoolers, right, in pre-kindergarten classes who are very active. They won't stay seated for circle time, and they might play only with their Thomas the Tank Engine toy. I suppose Thomas the Tank Engine toys should become one of my sponsors since I mentioned them so often. Anyway, so with these kinds of typical cases, we end up with sort of textbook diagnoses driving care decisions. So for instance, for our substance-dependent adult, that person might first be sent to a 12-step program, AA, NA, something like that. Loved ones might be sent to Nar-Anon or Al-Anon. For our now labeled sex offender, some of those kids are incarcerated in juvenile hall. Not a good outcome, not moving forward with your life. For the misbehaving school-age child, lots of times we start out in the schools with positive behavioral management. We want to stop rewarding the child for acting out, things like that. And for our preschooler in the pre-K class, well, maybe we'll wait and retry pre-K next year. You know, so those are just some of the ways that we think in a very linear fashion about these kinds of situations and say, okay, this is what you should do. However, digging deeper, by the time they get to me, they've usually seen a few doctors already, and we're thinking about, is there something else going on? We see these people when other approaches have failed, the linear ones. All of the people who I'm talking about here, all of these kinds of cases, if you will, at different ages, have turned out to have longstanding impairments in social communication and in their range of interests, i.e. some sort of form of an autism spectrum disorder. So at the root of that, their trouble is this form of broad phenotype, we call it ASD. And of course, we recommend evidence-based practice approaches to addressing these deficits. Well, we need to understand what evidence-based practice is. And I'm going to get to these different combinations of diagnoses in a minute, but let's talk about evidence-based practice. You've heard the term, I'm sure, many, many times. You probably also heard the terms evidence-based medicine and evidence-based treatment. Well, here's the thing. In about 1995, a gentleman named Sackett published a letter in the British Medical Journal saying that, you know, when we're trying to figure out what's best for patients, we usually don't have all the information we'd like to have. We don't have data that says specifically what you should do in a specific situation, oftentimes combination situations where you're combining two medicines instead of one for diabetes or whatever it is. You usually have, at best, short-term drug studies, 8 weeks, that might be controlled, which is nice, but just nothing that really tells us what to do in real life. So what he proposed was a model where you took that relevant research, but you combined it with clinician judgment and experience so that you weren't either just using one scientific paper, evidence-based treatment, right, not just using a paper somebody wrote to drive treatment so that everybody with diabetes, for instance, has to have one kind of medicine because the studies show that that medicine works. On the other hand, you didn't want to just use clinical judgment without any research because a lot of times you go off the rails. Many of us are very convinced that a particular treatment is, you know, really helpful all the time, but when we don't have real evidence for that, it makes it hard for people looking, you know, objectively from the outside to say, well, are you sure that wasn't a placebo effect or something like that? Over the years since 1995, the American Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine adopted that and broadened it to take into account family, culture, and values. So the current definition of evidence-based practice, since 2001 actually, is this combination of taking relevant research, which is sometimes controlled trials, sometimes other kinds of studies, clinical judgments, and the clinician should take this information, give to the family some choices about things, and then the family can make real informed consent decisions based on their own culture and values. So, for instance, I might be, you know, really gung-ho about floor time, and I really am. If you haven't seen the CBC story on it showing brain changes in a positive way in kids with autism, you need to see that. It came out this past week. But That said, I may be pushing floor time, and a family may not want that. They may really be interested in an ABA approach, feel more comfortable with that, a little bit more structured, a little bit more directive for the child. Okay, well, what am I doing pushing this on a family that doesn't want it? It doesn't make any sense. And vice versa. There are plenty of families who want to use a relationship-based, warm, engaging, affective approach, and they're pushed into maybe a more structured approach, and it doesn't fit. So that's the idea of evidence-based practice. Families are the people who choose based on their culture and values, but they choose from relevant research and clinical judgment and experience. Got it? So we usually don't have enough research to say what's going to be best, but we have relevant research. Clinicians use their judgment and experience in vetting the research to provide families with choices so that they can make informed consent decisions based on their own culture and values. All right, well, let's talk about differential diagnosis and multiple diagnostic considerations, because that's the problem. That's why we have to use this evidence-based practice approach, because we don't have, you know, you've got an infection, we give you the antibiotic kind of situation. What we have instead is many, many different things going on. In our cases, we've got ASD plus, right? ASD plus substance abuse, maybe a diagnosable obsessive compulsive disorder, maybe depression in our adult. In our adolescent, we have an autism spectrum disorder, an apparent conduct disorder, and apparently pedophilia in this particular adolescent. In the school-age child, well, it looks like we've got an autism spectrum disorder, a reading disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, someone who's just defying you and knows they're doing it to get out of doing something, and perhaps bipolar disorder, that mood instability, or in DSM-5, the newer disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. Get used to that term. And then finally, in our preschooler, ASD plus, maybe ADHD, ooh, I wrote ASD there again, and then OCD. So an obsessive or perseverative child who's very active and impulsive, but has these autism spectrum disorder qualities going on. We want to remember that plenty of times there are genetic links between all these things, between autism, ADHD, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. They tend to run in families together. There have been some genetic linkages shown, particularly between autism and ADHD. So we think about these things as very mixed, right? We have very little research on numbers of people who have these combinations or on what you do about treatment with these combinations. So we often need to rely on clinical intuition, which, as it turns out, can be pretty consistent with a little bit of research that we have. I did an experiment recently that had to do with crowdsourcing to get a group of experts to help me think about how often these things come together. My ideas come from a book, The Wisdom of Crowds, and other sources, but James Cyrulwicki has this wonderful book. If you've heard about crowdsourcing, and if you've read this book, you've heard some of the examples that Cyrulwicki gives. For instance, about maybe 120 years ago, a gentleman, I think by the name of Watson, I'm not remembering right now, went to a county fair in England. He was a guy who didn't have a lot of faith in regular people. He figured that maybe like Thomas Paine, countries should be run by the people who are the smartest, high intellect types, right? So he goes to a county fair, and at the fair, people are guessing the weight of a cow, and if somebody guesses the weight of the cow, they get to keep the cow. Well, he got all these tickets from all the people who made all the guesses. And what it turned out is that the actual weight of the cow was just about the same as the average of all the guesses of this huge crowd of diverse people. Some were experts, some were just, you know, there for fun, whatever. But it was very interesting that when you averaged the guesses, you got the weight of the cow. It was pretty amazing. And it kind of surprised him and was counterintuitive because, of course, he expected that there would be all these really crazy guesses, but that nobody would really be close. There were a few that were quite close, of course, and somebody did win the cow. But it's that averaging of a diverse group of independent choices that was really interesting to him. Similarly, Cyrulwicki talks about a situation that the U.S. Navy had about 20 years ago when we lost a submarine in the North Atlantic. And, of course, people need to find a sub, and usually it's very much a needle in a haystack. It's very difficult to find a submarine, and one would expect it might take years and years. And all the human and security issues connected with that were certainly very pressing at the time. Well, what the commander in charge did is he got a number of individual experts to give their guesses as to the location of the sub. And you got people who knew about submarines. You got people who knew about how do you get stuff up from the bottom of the ocean, people from different walks of life but related to this kind of problem. When he averaged the locations that people predicted the sub would be, he got an answer that turned out to be within 200 yards of the actual location of the sub and saved probably years. It only took a couple months to find this sub. It's similarly, and although Sarecki doesn't mention it, we know that in the field of biomolecular science, people are now using crowdsourcing on the internet to put out chemical formulae so that just lay people out there in the internet with apparently nothing better to do can look at the structures of protein molecules or guess the structures. And when all the guesses are averaged, usually they get a pretty good picture of the protein molecule, and it saves years in trying to figure out what these things look like. It's an amazing process, putting a lot of separate brains together when those brains are acting independently and then averaged by somebody else. And finally, when you're driving in traffic, you have to think about how everybody acts in a cooperative way. So think about that. You have all kinds of people moving in a flow pattern where they're responding to each other as if they were one sort of intelligence, but spread out among a whole lot of different people. It's an interesting thing to think about, that many people together can create a powerful form of artificial intelligence, as my friend Bill Fisher at SimPlay calls it. So I figured I'd use some crowdsourcing with a group of experts a couple weeks ago in preparation for this talk. And in that, I had to have a couple considerations. One, I needed independence. I had to make sure that the people in the room hadn't read the one paper that exists, or that they hadn't all read it anyway. There's always a few experts who've read everything around. I wanted to avoid any anchoring influences. So when I was asking about the probable rates of ASD combined with, say, depression, I didn't want to be presenting the usual rates of depression or bipolar or whatever ahead of time, because that might influence what people were thinking. And finally, I needed to do blind rating. I couldn't have people seeing what other people were voting, because that would influence them as well. I also wanted diversity, experts and amateurs. And in the room, I had experts from different fields, from speech, from OT, from social work, PhD psychologists. I also had some parent advocates. So everybody was very familiar with the field of ASD or very interested in it. I had another psychiatrist or two in there as well. And yet, nobody did exactly the same job, so I hoped that it would be diverse enough. And then finally, I needed a sorting mechanism. I didn't have electronics to use, so I had one of my colleagues, Sarah Reed, PhD at Rady Children's Hospital, UCSD, read the crowd so that I wasn't trying to guess and average what the crowd was saying, because that would have biased the results as well. So this is what I had people do. And you can do this at home when we go along. We're going to do actually today, right now, artificial intelligence, sort of pretending. So when I go through these slides, I want you to make your guesses in the comfort of your own home. I'll show you how to do that. And I'll tell you what my diverse group of experts said, and you can compare your answer. And maybe one day we'll have real-time tech for this and more research on numbers and treatment comparisons too, so that when we're doing these talks, there's another link on the website or something that you can really do it. So here's how we did it. I hope you can all see the slides. This is the crowdsourcing how to vote slide. And if you can't see it, it's a picture of a woman who, I don't really have her sitting at a desk, but everybody was sitting at tables. And if they believed, for instance, something 100%, they'd have their hand almost straight up in the air. I didn't put it absolutely straight up because it would have covered her face, and I didn't want to cover her face. If they felt that it was absolutely doubtful, their hand would be straight out on the table, so it wouldn't be elevated at all. And maybes were in between, about 45 degrees plus or minus, depending on the percent or the strength with which someone believes something. If you can see the picture, the cartoon, the woman has her eyes closed, because we don't want people looking at each other's answers. Although, obviously, if you can feel the motion sort of next to you, people jostling, you might get a little bit of information. But for the most part, that helps. And then this is a woman I show because almost everybody in the room was a woman. There may have been one other guy there. So that is another thing that kind of biases these results a little bit, or maybe a lot. I don't know. So when you're at home, if you're willing to do this, put your hand straight out on your table or leave it down if you don't believe something, all the way up if you believe it 100%, and we'll see how that goes. I did some test questions with people just to get them some practice ahead of time, but we'll skip that today. The paper I was comparing to was Lignaga's 2011 paper, Psychiatric Comorbidity in Young Adults with a Clinical Diagnosis of Asperger's Syndrome. So that's part of the broad spectrum of ASDs, Asperger's, but it's not everybody, right? And it's young adults, so again, it's not everybody by age, but it was one of the only studies I've seen that really looks at the percentages in about, I think, 56 people of these various disorders. So it's preliminary kinds of information, but the people who I was crowdsourcing didn't know this, you know, didn't know any of these numbers ahead of time, and you'll see how interesting the results are when we do this. So this is a study we're comparing with our intuition, and then we'll look at what the numbers are in the neurotypical population afterwards, which is also of great interest, I think. So here we go. The first question to the crowd and to you is what percentage of people with ASD also have depression at some point in their lifetime? Take a second. Put your arm in some position. If you think it's everybody, raise your hand all the way. If you think it's nobody, put your hand flat out. But you'll probably put it somewhere in between. Are you ready? Okay, this is what my group of experts said, 60%. And Lignaga in his study, what do you think he found? Unbelievable, 70%, really close. For recurrent depression, so once you have a depression, you might get another depression afterwards. That would be recurrent depression. So if you think about somebody who has an ASD and has had depression, what do you think the chances are that that person will get depression again? Got your answer? Think about it. Okay, so our crowd said 50%. And Lignaga, 50%, same number. So the research is matching with the crowd guess. Pretty interesting, huh? For bipolar disorder, manic depressive disorder, periods of highs in mood and lows in mood that are somewhat extended. I mean, you could have some moment-to-moment irritability, but we're thinking about people who really get into very, very euphoric states at times, or hypomanic, almost euphoric, very productive states, or at least focused, active states, and also into very depressed moments as well. So what do you think? How often do you think that happens in people with a broad-spectrum ASD? Raise your hand and make a guess. You ready? Okay, so here's what the crowd said. They said 15%. And Lignaga found 9%. Again, within a ballpark, within some error range, but, you know, not way off. What about anxiety disorders? Plenty of our people have anxiety disorders. What percentage do you think of people with a broad autism spectrum disorder at some point have an anxiety disorder? Nobody? Everybody? Somewhere in between? Raise your hand. Put it up there. Survey says 45%. Lignaga's study, 56%. Again, very close. So somewhere roughly around half. What about obsessive compulsive disorder? This is a little bit tricky, I think. I'll tell you why after I show you the numbers. Obsessive compulsive disorder and ASD. Raise your hands. Everybody, nobody, somewhere in between? Here's what the crowd said. 35%. Here's what Lignaga said. 7%. Why do you think that is? Obsessive compulsive disorder, per se, is actually a pretty specific kind of diagnosis with obsessions and compulsions. And when you actually look at the definition and you do it in a more formal manner, it's kind of different than the perseveration or rigid thinking that we tend to think about when we think about people with ASDs. So to me, it's not a surprise that those numbers are very, very different. And it should also not surprise you that it's actually a lot more difficult to treat these perseverative symptoms in persons with ASDs than in the general population when people have OCD. And similarly, when you've got someone with a fairly pure component of OCD with autism spectrum disorder, that's actually often more treatable than the more general perseverative symptoms. And that's been borne out in a lot of research. What about ADHD? Almost all our kids are diagnosed with ADHD before they're diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. At least that's how it used to be until we were maybe a little bit better at picking this up. Raise your hand and tell me how many you think have ADHD along with ASD. I may have given something away or anchored you in a certain direction just by making those comments before. But if you raise your hand, our crowd said 25%. Low in my estimate, Lagnega said 30%. I would have said, you know, I would have raised my hand all the way up. No, no research I know. What about substance abuse disorders? We had that first adult case we talked about, right? So how many people throughout a lifetime end up with a substance use difficulty? Now, a lot of our kids on the spectrum never get to the point where they're able to enact a substance abuse disorder unless it's an apparent addiction to some of the medications or things like that, which is interesting, but probably not what we're talking about exactly. Here he's talking about, what Nate was talking about, Asperger's, but there are plenty of people along the broader spectrum who have substance use disorders. So what percentage would you guess? Ready? So our crowd guessed 5%. Lagnega found 7%. So not a lot, about 1 in 20-ish. Tourette's, a lot of our people have tics and twitches. Tourette's disorder, 6% in the crowd. Lagnega found 2%. Again, I think that probably reflects an understanding of Tourette's, like with OCD, that's broader than if you use strict diagnostic criteria. And then finally, he looked at psychosis. So how many people with an autism spectrum disorder have a psychotic condition as well? Delusions, hallucinations. You know, we call autism a childhood schizophrenia. And yet, when the crowd looked at it, they got 3%. When Lagnega looked at it, he got 2%. Really interesting. Let's look at the neurotypical numbers for these as well. Very, very interesting when you think about what happens in the general population. So I just put them all in at once. For depression, about a quarter of us get a depression during our lifetime. For those of us who, also about 12.5% of us get a recurrent depression, but that's a little bit of a misnomer for recurrent in that the number there, you see 50% who get it again, for the crowd in Lagnega, it's actually 50% of people who get a depression get another depression. So that's an error in the slide that I should probably fix. I'm going to write a note to myself right now about that. So it's 50-50-50 all the way across the board, for real. Bipolar disorder happens about 1% of our population, as does OCD, Tourette's, and psychotic disorders. And you can see they're running at lower or much lower rates than what we're finding so far in the spectrum community. Anxiety disorders in about a quarter of the general population. Not a shock that it's double in the spectrum population. And ADHD, 1 in 20 people worldwide in several cultures have ADHD among the neurotypical population. And then looks like 5 or 6 times that would meet those criteria in the autism spectrum population. And again, that may reflect some of the genetic linkages between the two. Excuse me. And look at substance abuse. That one, kind of like recurrent depression, runs just about the same across the board. So it's not particularly more frequent in our people with spectrum disorders. Of course, we've got a lot of people with Asperger's who have learned the rule that you're not supposed to drink or smoke, and so they don't. Let's look at maturational and developmental considerations in spectrum disorders and mixed disorders too. Because it's important when you've got an adult, say around late 20s, early 30s, what's that time of life all about? It's about connecting with a life partner and being productive when you're living a life that I suppose is usual, neurotypical, if there is any usual among neurotypicals. But there's apparently some kind of biologic drive around 20s, 30s, something like that, to connect with people, to connect with a life partner, and also a drive to, you know, have a career and be productive. So when you think about our person with a spectrum disorder, and some compulsions and depressions and things like that, and the inability to keep a job, you just need to think about the contrast between that trouble connecting with people that this person has, that trouble connecting and keeping a job that this person has, the troubles that ensue when they're unable to meet the expectations of this time of life. And those expectations may be cultural, but they might also have an internal component to them. For the adolescent, we think about adolescents as coming into a lot of hormones, a lot of sexual drive, as well as individuation, trying to figure out who they are in the world. And here you've got an adolescent who has a sexual drive but doesn't connect very well with other people to be able to date, do things like that that might help relieve some of that tension of figuring out who you are and getting your sex drive and needs met a little bit to the extent that parents will allow you. And so it kind of veers off in a different direction, kind of off the rails of typical kinds of things that an adolescent guy might be doing. Not a lot of adolescent guys might be babysitting, for instance. They might be playing sports and exploring dating. For our school-age child, well, self-esteem comes from learning to do things and learning to do them well, having competence. We've got a school-age child who's having a lot of trouble. Again, trouble connecting, trouble relating, trouble learning, and so doesn't feel very good about himself or herself, and then gets into these oppositional and tantrum moments. And finally, the needs of the social and cultural demands on a preschool child are to manage one's body control, toileting, and then also staying still in your seat so you can start to learn, and the competing relationships among adults, figuring out, and not beyond just how do you get along with a parent, but how do you get along with different adults who have different demands on you, mom versus dad, teacher versus parent, that kind of thing. And here you've got a child who really isn't negotiating those things well, isn't understanding what people are wanting, reading intent, and so is just much more likely to be having these kinds of conflicts, difficulties, and symptoms. When we look at family systems aspects and other systems aspects of these situations, an adult is expected to take care of himself. He's not supposed to need a whole system around him to support him at work or to facilitate his interactions at home. The teenager, well, this teen was available, right? Mom wanted him to be doing something productive and social, a good thought on mom's part on the one hand, helping out, getting him a job, babysitting. So here you've got families that are often trying to do good, trying to find something that works for the teen, but then in the end it doesn't work out, and in this case in a terrible outcome. The school-age child is expected to go to school and do his work. And here, of course, this child is unable to meet those expectations, and the preschool child is similarly expected to cooperate and join the group, and again, isn't able to meet those demands. Let's talk for a little bit about how we diagnose autism and other disorders and how we pick these various aspects apart. Do we have a way of trying to organize all these different things so that we can understand what's going on and what we might do? Well, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, you've probably heard about it, is the Bible for making diagnoses in psychiatry and a lot of neurobehavioral medicine. It's been around for decades and decades in many, many different forms. But in 1980 is when it began looking at pure disorders with definitive kinds of, looking for definitive and effective treatment for those disorders. So it set up criteria for research for things like MDD, major depressive disorder, ADHD, attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And it's done a pretty good job with those kinds of disorders, figuring out when do you have it, when do you not have it, what treatments work and what treatments don't work, when those are in a pure setting without other things combined. What we end up doing, however, when we've got these more complex cases is we find more factors and more diagnoses, and it gets a lot more muddy. We have complex situations that require complex approaches. So the DSM does give us other axes, so to speak, to address some of these areas. And then the DMIC, the Diagnostic Manual for Infants and Children, which can be thought of even for adults, has even more axes to think about all these different things and help us organize our approach. So here's the different axes for the DSM and the the DMIC. The DSM has your major diagnosis, could be autism, could be depression, you could list a few of them up there. The second axis, axis two, talks about characterological traits. So for people who are particularly dramatic and erratic or somewhat antisocial or might be some people who are very obsessive and rigid in their character, that's what axis two in DSM talks about, similar kinds of things. It also talks about that old word retardation, which of course we're changing now to intellectual disability, but the old one still has that word retardation in it. Axis 3 talks about medical problems someone might have that could certainly influence behavior and influence emotions and influence thought and cognition and learning. Axis 4 talks about the level of stress that the person is under, mild, moderate, or severe. And finally, Axis 5 is a global assessment of function on a scale of 1 to 100 or 1 to 90, depending on who you read, who you believe. But the scale is kind of like a ballpark of how someone is doing in life. So if you're not doing well, it's kind of low. If you're doing really great, it's kind of high. Nobody gets 100, I don't think, ever. Most people, if they're doing pretty well, get somewhere in the 80s or 90s. People who are just barely functioning but kind of hanging on to their school placement or something like that might be somewhere in the 50s, 60s. And someone who's needing hospitalization or institutionalization may be, you know, in the teens, 20s, maybe 30s, something like that. So just to give you an idea. The DMIC speaks to primary diagnosis, but then it moves to, on axis two, functional, emotional, developmental capacity. So that's the basic ability to relate and communicate. Can you be regulated? Can you be engaged with somebody else? Can you have an interaction with somebody? Can you get into a flow of interaction with other people? And can that flow of interaction become more symbolic and complex and those kinds of things? And of course, developmentally, those abilities come in throughout infancy and early childhood and then get more and more robust and complex through adolescence and adulthood. The MIC also talks specifically about regulatory sensory processing capacity, something that's really commonly a problem in our people on the spectrum. And then talks to language capacities and also splits out visual spatial capacities, which is a very important thing to think about. We have eyes front. We're predators, right? And a lot of our world, if we are sighted people, not everybody is sighted, but for the people who are, a lot of our information as well as our distractibility, our way of understanding the world, comes from our visual system. So there's regulatory sensory language. And by the way, by language, we mean not nearly spoken language, which is important, and spoken comprehension of language or comprehension of spoken language, but also all the nonverbal cueing and reading somebody else's cues, which is also somewhat visual, and responding to those cues in a way that is useful. And so that kind of brings us to the child, caregiver, and family patterns. So we also look at what's immediately surrounding the person and how well those relationships are going, how able a parent is, for instance, to be able to comfort a child who is dysregulated, to be able to create an engaged and pleasurable moment, to read and respond to the cues of the child and to generally support that child's development. There's an axis for stress here as well and an axis for other medical and neurologic diagnoses. The reason I present this DMIC is that I think it does offer a broader way of looking at diagnosis. It gives you more clues to what might be going on and therefore ways that you might intervene to try to help a child or an adult with a spectrum disorder and a lot of other things going on. The DSM-4 is currently in the DSM-4-TR mode. It's been around in DSM-4 since the 90s. Excuse me. But as you probably have heard, the criteria are going to be changing with DSM-5 to be published in maybe a year or two. There's been a lot of controversy about the DSM-5. People have been worried that the new criteria for autism might cut out a large section of people who previously carried a high-functioning diagnosis. I don't think that that's going to be the case. The field trials are ongoing right now, but let me tell you the quick story on that. The committee that was looking at autism and autism spectrum disorders wanted to change the old understanding to a more modern spectrum understanding. So previously you had to have a certain number of symptoms and categories to have the diagnosis, but we were recognizing that there are a lot of people with a few symptoms who are really having struggles in their life. So the committee came up with a spectrum kind of diagnosis, and they're calling it autism spectrum disorder, as opposed to autistic disorder, as opposed to having a separate Asperger's. Of course, the Asperger community is self-identified and is concerned about, well, what do you mean there's no Asperger's disorder? And I think most of us in psychiatry anyway feel that anybody can simply continue to identify with the Asperger community. The problem has been that research hasn't been able to distinguish the difference yet between what we call high-functioning autism, where people might not have had very good language function early on, but now it's pretty good, versus people with Asperger's disorder, who apparently have pretty good language function early on, but challenges in relating and pragmatic language, the back-and-forth banter, those kinds of things. So when you can't distinguish those, then maybe you need to redefine and study the spectrum, different levels of challenge along the spectrum. So that's the idea. One of the icons in the field, a gentleman named Fred Volkmar, looked at the new criteria and used kind of older cases and older symptoms to try to see how that would flesh out, and found that when we look at symptoms for autism based on 1993 thinking, which is when his data came from that he used to kind of put it through this new rubric, you got fewer people diagnosed. And so that obviously caused a lot of concern. There were headlines, things like that. But when you use our more current and modern understanding of these symptoms, which I think is, in fact, more realistic and broader, my belief, and we'll see in the field trials for DSM-5, will likely result in actually a broader and more people diagnosed along the autism spectrum. And for my purposes, that's a good thing, because I've got plenty of people who come to me because they've seen a bunch of doctors or whatever, and someone thinks maybe they have an ASD, they can't hold a job, et cetera. But when we clarify that there is an ASD going on and we get appropriate supports in place, we can often take someone who's been sitting at home on the computer outside in the world, at a job, much happier, maybe with some social relationships and paying taxes. So it's a much better outcome. So I do think that, I do hope anyway, that the new formulation of the criteria for DSM-5 will help our population. Of course, that will also create questions about who gets what when you've got limited amounts of resources to provide support. So there is that issue. I don't have the answer for it today, but my hope is to create more taxpayers, if nothing else, that'll give us more resources. There's a difference that I want to highlight between the DSM-4-TR categorical, we call it Chinese menu, type of looking at diagnosis. We've got a couple different categories. You need a couple different things from each category to call the diagnosis, versus this DSM-5 dimensional way of looking at things. So you've got a number of different symptoms and you look at severity across the spectrum. The other difference, by the way, for ASD is that there used to be three categories of main concern in the DSM-4, social function, language, and communicative function, and restricted range of interest. In the DSM-5, they've appropriately collapsed social and communication into one category because, again, those things are very hard to tease out with the research that's been done over the past 20 years or so, and restricted range of interest remains a separate category from the two. But in looking at this difference between categorical and dimensional spectrum, there's some interesting research to consider, and it's not regarding autism, but regarding a very different diagnosis called borderline personality disorder. There was a paper recently by Zimmerman who looked at people diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. Borderline personality disorder, I won't go through all the criteria, but it's characterized by people who often have a habit of really idolizing people and then vilifying the same people when they get angry with them. Often feel very empty inside, suffer bouts of depression, suicidality, mood instability. Many of these people have suffered abuse previously, and that may be related to it. And many of them are treated as if they have a mood instability or bipolar disorder, sometimes with some help. But more often there are therapies called things like dialectical behavioral therapy that are helpful in helping people have a little bit more perspective and thinking about more options of what's going on and what they might do. So the reason why I bring this up is because Zimmerman looked at the difference between categorical and dimensional kinds of thinking with a borderline personality disorder. What he found was that after a certain threshold number of symptoms of borderline personality disorder, 5, 6, or 7 of the symptoms, there's very little difference in the overall functional impairment among the patients. They're having a lot of trouble, you know, whether they have 5, 6, or 7 of these symptoms. And that supports this categorical kind of definition that was in DSM-4 and would be reflected like in the ADOS, the Autism Diagnostic Observation Spectrum or Scale, that was often used to support a diagnosis of whether someone's autistic or not autistic, right? So you have it or you don't kind of thinking. But people with one symptom of borderline personality disorder are, interestingly, significantly impaired compared to those with no symptoms. So what does that tell us? That for these quote-unquote subclinical cases, and think about our people with ASDs who have maybe just a couple symptoms but not enough to, quote, make the diagnosis, they're still significantly impaired. There's still something that deserves our attention and support to help the person become a functional person, citizen, friend, lover, whatever, right? So that's support for the dimensional spectrum. For example, those functional, emotional, developmental levels that I spoke about for the DMIC, looking at the ability to be regulated, engaged, or part of a flow of interaction, et cetera, those in the DMIC have a Likert scale, kind of a 1 to 7 scale, about how well someone is doing in any of these functional capacities in their life. And that really helps us understand the person a lot better. If you can't regulate very well, then maybe you can't relate to anybody very well. But if you're very regulated, but you're getting stuck when it comes to the back and forth interaction, you just don't know quite what to do or how to do that, again, it pinpoints places where you can intervene, and it can be very, very liberating in terms of figuring out how to help somebody move forward. So, again, these categorical and dimensional views may both be valid at different times, may both be different but useful ways of looking at challenges that people have. Well, so I've gone through a number of different things already. We've carried our cases a long way. We've talked about how diagnosis can drive these sort of linear decisions. We've talked about how ASD can help explain why people got where they've gotten. We've talked about evidence-based practice and how we don't usually have a paper that tells us just what to do. So we really do need to use relevant research with clinician experience and give families the choice in figuring out what's going to fit best for them. We've talked about some of the combinations of these disorders and how often they might occur. We've talked about maturational systems aspects and now these diagnostic systems that, if they work, might help us at least parse it out so that we can figure out a little bit more what's going on and what to do. But how do we really move forward to plan on an ongoing basis? Planning involves brainstorming, right? That's sort of what we've been doing here today. We've been brainstorming about diagnosis, brainstorming about causes or factors at play. That's certainly what the DMIC or to an extent the DSM 4 or 5 do to try to give us some ideas about what might be going on. And then, of course, we do more brainstorming about what we might do. What are all the different therapies that might be considered? Everything's on the table. And then you look at, okay, is there some relevant research? Is there some clinical experience? What fits with the family, using that evidence-based practice process to try to figure out what might be reasonable to think about, and then prioritizing and combining things so that you're not giving 28 recommendations to a family or receiving 28 recommendations. I'm not sure which is worse, probably receiving them. But figuring out what's going to make sense for a family. What couple things can we start with to move forward? Whenever we have a plan, though, we need to adjust it. No plan works right. We always need to have, well, I mean, we think about IEP meetings or team meetings, things like that. And what I'm going to make a pitch for right now for you is a reflective process to help us navigate as we move forward. It's a little bit different, I think, than how a lot of our team meetings or IEPs go. A reflective parallel process is a community in which you've got people with challenges, the people who support, work with our caregivers, parents, teachers to those people with challenges, the professionals who support the caregivers and teachers, et cetera, and then the colleagues of the professionals who support the caregivers, teachers, parents, who support the people with challenges. And so you've got this whole system of people being there for other people so that nobody's left isolated and wondering, how am I going to move forward? I feel like I'm so alone. I don't know what to do. That's what we're trying to move away from, move toward building community. And in this community, we try to be non-directive. We try to avoid telling people what to do, but to help them problem solve. And what does that do? That helps create confidence in one's own competence to solve problems in everyday life and intervention. If you know anything about Dr. Tronick's work at Harvard about babies and moms, where babies learn to repair an interaction with a mom and develop their own confidence in their own competence to do that, and their initiative and their ability to tolerate stress. It's marvelous work. This is very similar to that. And again, it's not that you're just sitting there like a silent therapist saying, what do you think you should do? It's, let's think about what's going on together. I'm not sure I can tell you what to do because you know your child better than I do, but you know, there are some things that have worked for me in other situations. I don't know if you want to try those out if they fit. And then we can talk about it and, you know, come back and we can, you know, put our heads together a little bit more together. But that's very different than me saying, go fix it yourself. It's also very different from me saying, you have to do this, 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 and this, which doesn't necessarily help the person who's trying to problem solve become more of their own person in doing it. It certainly may be obvious that, for instance, if structure is lax or support is not enough, it's often a question of balancing support versus expectations. We don't want too much of one or the other. We have to somehow find the middle ground, right? But if you just tell someone that, then they're not really discovering it on their own. And so if you want someone to discover it on your own, you can talk about what might be working, how they were feeling in the situation, those kinds of things. And there's a way to formalize how you do that, and I'll get to that in a second. But the idea here is that we're living by a platinum rule. You want to treat others as you would like them to treat others. So if I'm working with a parent, my hope is that I'm doing a good job of treating that person the way I hope they'll treat their child. I'm not dictating to them. I'm not helpful at all. I'm somehow finding that middle ground to support them so that they can find it to support their child. It seems to work. So a good listener treats you with respect so that you have the support to be able to tolerate the natural stress of helping your child, right? So the experience from the end of the parent, or for me with my colleagues when I'm getting help from them, is that they're treating me with respect so that I have the support to be able to tolerate the stress of trying to help the family. Because it is a stressful thing. Everybody in the system is undergoing stress, and everybody really needs this kind of support to be able to productively move forward and grow. So breaking it down, 0-3 puts out some nice pamphlets on this. Good listening, as it turns out, is not therapy, but it is a very helpful thing. What is good listening? It's looking at the person you're trying to help and how they seem to be feeling. Try to read what's going on. Read the cues of the child if you're the parent or caregiver or therapist. Reading the cues of the parent if you're the therapist or professional trying to help coach a parent. Reading the cues of the professional if you're the colleague of the professional trying to help your colleague out. Listening to what the person's saying, really listening to what the main concerns are. People will usually tell you what they're worried about, and they'll usually tell you 3 times, 4 times if you don't seem to be listening. They'll keep at it, so keep listening for it. Excuse me. And then finally, learning, trying to figure out how to support the person in problem solving. So that's something you do together. You spend the time with the person to try to sort through wondering what has worked in other situations, things that may have worked for this child with certain people. Maybe you could find a nugget of success where you can think about what that situation was like and try to figure out what the ingredients were and then bridge that over to make it bigger and more generalized. And this reflective community really requires nurturing because there are always new challenges. Nothing ever goes exactly as expected. And we rarely have the support and time we need to think things through with others. I have the honor of spending a lot of time in my practice calling up teachers and spending time with them. Like, for instance, I'll go to a school 2-3 times a year to observe and try to help out. But then in between, every couple of weeks, I'll spend a half hour on the phone or so with the teacher and talk about how it's going and try to support that teacher. It's a very rare experience for most people, and that's unfortunate. The experience here in San Diego recently, Rady Children's Hospital, speech and language therapy department, recently put in a reflective process into their department, because what it did for them is it gave people the time to think through their cases and made the care so much more efficient and effective. And departments that do that tend to find their patient satisfaction go way up, because the treatment's more effective. People feel more supported, not just the staff, but the families, and then the kids do better. When the parents do better, the kids do better, as research has shown us time and again. But again, we rarely have the support to do that. So although when we do this, we save a lot of time and energy in the long run, we need to make that time. We need to have regularly scheduled meetings. So again, for me, it might be meeting with a teacher every couple weeks on the phone or what have you. In the moment, what do? When you're trying to support somebody or when you're being supported, it's important to have a lot of humility. You don't have the answer. I mean, none of us ever knows for sure what's going on in somebody else's head or situation. So you know, you need to stay humble, facilitate problem solving, wonder about the situation. It's good to wonder about, you know, what, you know, I wonder what that felt like when you were there. I wonder what that was like for the child or the, whoever it was we're trying to help. I wonder what it's like now, just even thinking about it. Tracking that emotion then and now is often really helpful in figuring out where the difficulties are. And certainly if something comes up that's a real a sticking point for a person, then, yeah, certainly maybe therapy would be helpful. But we're talking about the day-to-day challenges of just working in and among helping people with any kinds of difficulties, but in particular difficulties with relating, communicating, and learning. I like to make statements more than ask questions. I think when I ask a question, it kind of puts me holier than thou and above people. So instead of saying, so how did you feel about that? What I say instead might be, wow, I mean, that seems like it must have felt awful. And I might be wrong, but that's fine. I can be corrected. But I'm not presuming to know, and I'm keeping myself one step below the person I'm trying to support. Same thing with kids. Same thing with adults I do therapy with. And then when you think about it that way, you become empowering versus dictating. You're not telling someone how they should have felt. You're more wondering with them and empowering them to kind of teach you what it was like and to feel better about understanding themselves and how things are going. So the summary of all of this is to think broadly and brainstorm about what might be going on and what you might do, to think practically and prioritize what you're going to do and what you're going to try to do, and to nurture this reflective process so that there's a community of support that you're building in a fashion that's going to help move the ball forward bit by bit. You know how it is, a couple steps forward, a couple steps back. And, you know, I finished a lot sooner than I thought I would when I pre-recorded this talk. I think I was so sick it took me an hour and 20 minutes. Here I am, just an hour and 3 minutes or something. So we have plenty of time for questions.
Stretch it out. The link has been corrected now. So if you go onto the Moms Fighting Autism website, you can definitely click the link and go to the space where you can submit a question and all that kind of thing. I have a question here for you, Dr. Fader. It's from Alfred in Kenya. The question is, I have a 9-year-old daughter who was diagnosed with autism at the age of 3. I give her strict diet free from animal fat, wheat, specific fruits, etc., but she is still hyper. We've tried to toilet train her to no avail. She still can't feed herself. We enrolled her in a special school, but it seems not to be helping, and we are considering pulling her out. Do you have any suggestions? I'm not sure what their main struggle with. It looks like they're struggling with a lot of different things, but I think hyper was the one he was focusing on today.
Yeah, as it turns out, we haven't successfully been able to find diets that work generally for people on the spectrum, although There are different kinds of diets that people have tried, and some people report gluten-free, casein-free diets sometimes help, and some people report that salicylate-free diets help. So salicylates are the ingredient in aspirin that makes some people kind of up and kind of buzz, and is in red apples but not yellow apples, and purple grapes but not green grapes, things like that. So, you know, these are worth considering. It's also worth considering, if they haven't had the opportunity, whether there might be some other underlying neurologic disorder going on. So it may be worth thinking about whether there's an underlying seizure disorder, because if that's treated appropriately, whether through a ketogenic diet, actually, or through medication if necessary, which is the standard kind of treatment, sometimes that helps tremendously in helping someone become more regulated. The other thing is, whenever I hear about someone being very hyper and then not moving forward, I think about those functional, emotional, developmental capacities, and I think about, is there ever a moment when the child is calm and not asleep? Is there some place where we can kind of move in and be part of what her life is like? And then, is there a way to expand on that very gradually and slowly? And you'd be surprised, not always, but often enough, we can enter that person's world, even if it is mimicking a lot of what they're doing, even if it is almost matching or matching their energy level, and start to work on some kind of connectedness and then interaction and then flow of interaction. It's not an easy process. As you said, I mean, she's 9 and a half. She was diagnosed years and years ago. And it's not an easy kind of approach necessarily, but if nothing else has worked, it is the kind of thing that we often try. Certainly people think about using medications. That's part of what my job is. And sometimes a medication can support a good enough plan. A plan that is trying to do this, sometimes a medicine can help someone be a little bit more regulated so that you can get a little bit of engagement, get a little bit of reciprocity, and then be able to move from there to learning about feeding or toileting or some of these other things. And when I look at a special school, I wonder about what is the idea that the teachers or the staff have about why the person has the challenges they have. Is it merely that they believe the child doesn't have the intellect, or are they looking at that area of regulation and engagement and all the things that go into regulation? I'll even list those. So, I mean, you can list them in a lot of different ways, but when you're thinking about this ability to relate and communicate, Stan Greenspan, one of my mentors of blessed memory, talked about this learning tree where the roots of the tree were your ability to modulate and process sensory information, motor tone and motor planning abilities, the ability to read and respond to cues and to verbalizations of language, that visual spatial function that we talked about before, and then also the ability to have an idea then do something with that idea. You know, typically people have an idea, then they come up with a plan, then a sequence, and then they execute the sequence and adapt the sequence. And you can hear, you know, kind of between the lines here that this child might have ideas sometimes, but it's not clear that there's a plan, a sequence, any of that going on. So all these different routes, from sensory to language to executive function, those kinds of things, you have to kind of look at those and see what you can do to help stabilize some of those, and then get to some of that regulation and engagement and reciprocity, so that you can then, in the branches and leaves of the tree, start learning those skills like toilet training, like self-feeding, like relating, communicating, and more formal ways and learning skills. So that would be the answer, sort of a broad DIR, developmental individual differences, relationship-based approach type answer. And I'd certainly encourage the STAD to take a look at Circle Stretcher, take a look at icbl.com or perfectum.org, one or the other, and see if some of these more broad approaches might shed some light on this, you know, obviously very complex and challenging and heart-wrenching situation.
Mm-hmm. What are the benefits of identifying all the different comorbidities besides the obvious? You know, of getting services. I feel like with my son that we could just go on and just have an endless number of comorbidities, but what would be the benefits of actually getting a diagnostic identification of those comorbidities?
Well, you know, again, it's the beauty of brainstorming. So sometimes if you brainstorm, you think of the craziest thing, something that you thought of as crazy turns out to be important, turns out to be useful. You're thinking, and finally, whether it's the girl overseas from here or somebody else, you realize, you know what? You know, there was that time when she was petting that dog, and she and the dog seemed to be kind of communing. Well, that was kind of interesting. Does that mean you go out and buy a dog? Well, not necessarily. But it might mean that there is something about that particular sensory moment or emotional experience that was important. And there may be something about that that sheds light on where some of the sticking points are. I'll give you an example without identifying information. I had someone recently who, you know, really has had a lot of trouble, a lot of challenges in his life. And in looking, you know, kind of turning over all the rocks and doing all the brainstorming, what we figured out was that the particular kind of sensory processing in a particular modality was something that none of us had ever really thought about until we all kind of put our heads together, sort of averaged the information, kind of like crowdsourcing, and realized that if we just understood the child in this new way, in terms of this particular sensory modality, we could understand a lot of what was going on, and it really made possible some forward progress when we thought, you know, we were really pretty stuck. So I think there's real value in, spending our time. Look at it this way. We're going to have our kids. I have a kid with autism spectrum. We're going to have kids for life who are going to have challenges. And we kind of owe it to ourselves to take some time to keep thinking about what's going on, to keep bringing in fresh ideas, to keep wondering, is there something else that we haven't thought of? Not that we should stay up day and night and kill ourselves over it, but we should, in a supportive community, have the freshness of ideas to think about what are the current stresses, maturational systems, biological, that might be helping or hindering us so that we can find some of these clues to moving forward. As I said, I'll finish with this, you know, these are complex situations. And as we know, in engineering or medicine or developmental challenges, complex situations require complex solutions, and those complex solutions usually are comprised of a bunch of small successes, not big breakthroughs, but little successes here or there. And you got to keep your eyes open and your mind open and have the support and the new ideas to be able to try some of these things out and see if they're going to work.
Good. Okay, let me ask you this about the DSM changes. If they change the diagnostic criteria for autism in the DSM-5, will they then create a new category, do you think, for higher functioning, or what will happen to the people who fall off the autism?
They're going to lump them together more than split them apart. So you'll mostly be looking at how severe are some of the challenges versus whether or not you have this or that or the other. I mean, there are some things that are specific disorders that come under the general category of pervasive developmental disorders, such as Rett syndrome or childhood disintegrative disorder, that I think are going to remain stable. It's really the autism versus PDD-NOS versus Asperger's piece that's going to get more of a spectrum look to it.
So it'll fall under one umbrella.
More under one umbrella, and what that really means is when you're looking at individualized planning, you're not going to say, oh, he has autism, therefore we do ABA. You'll say, oh, he's got an autism spectrum disorder, let's figure out what his challenges are and figure out how we can meet his needs. It should be a little bit less linear and a little bit more thoughtful if it's carried out right. We'll have to see. And again, the field trials are still underway for DSM-5, so we're not sure yet exactly how your everyday clinician in your everyday clinic is going to include or not include people. It's an interesting question about diagnosis among people who don't necessarily do a lot of the diagnosis. You know what I'm talking about? So you've got pediatricians and maybe psychologists, kind of everyday people doing everyday jobs with your kids with ADD or anxiety or this or that, and they come across somebody with something different, and they say, oh, maybe this is autism, and oh, here are the new criteria. That's the broad population. of people who are making a lot of the diagnoses, and only after that, or maybe other some other kind of suspicion, do they send people to specialty clinics for people that, you know, like me, maybe a lot of us in the audience, have been living with this for a long, long time and have a different way of looking at the spectrum, a little bit more nuanced. So the question is how the less, who are the people who do this less as a primary task of their lives diagnose it, but also how the specialty clinics do as well. And I have a feeling that the specialty clinics are going to be pretty open to and willing to and wanting to use these new diagnostic criteria because they're the ones who pushed for it in the first place because they wanted to broaden it up. But it'll be interesting to see whether the people who don't use it as much or as often will see it that way. It'll be interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing what the field trials show.
And in talking about diagnostics, I was never really able to do anything with the autism diagnosis per se, but when I started to identify his symptoms, that's when we started to be able to select treatments. So is that more in line with what's going to be happening here in the new DSM-5, is that you'll get the diagnosis, but then you'll also get, you know, guidance as far as symptoms, comorbidities, and symptom treatments, or?
You know, that is exactly the point. I think you're right on target. The way that we look at this, well, when you're looking at, for instance, medication treatment, which is, you know, pretty iffy stuff for autism spectrum disorders, it doesn't work as well as with some other disorders, we look at symptoms more than we look at the diagnosis because it's really the target symptoms that are what you're prioritizing, what you're trying to make better. And then you end up borrowing ideas from other disorders to see, well, maybe this will work. Can we try it out? That's much more the level of knowledge and practical application that we're at than this is the diagnosis, therefore this is the treatment. Gets back to that point that I was trying to make about linear diagnosis where you have like a stomach infection with H. pylori causing your ulcer, you give the antibiotic and then the infection's gone and your ulcer gets better. Wouldn't that be great if we have that sort of an answer for autism spectrum disorders? We're clearly not at that point yet. And so we're more thinking about, okay, what are the symptoms? What can we do about them?
Mm-hmm. And I know that this is not the actual focus of your talk, but could you talk a little bit more about DIR and floor time? Because I know people will be asking about what is DIR, what is floor time?
Well, I'd be delighted to do that. So Stanley Greenspan and Serena Weider, over the past 40 years or so, started out actually in fussy baby clinics, looking at moms and their infants and how they were or weren't getting along. And along with probably 100 years of knowledge in child development, pulled together a theory and a practice that combines these ideas about individual differences where you've got, as I said, these sensory, motor, other kinds of difficulties that get in the way of one's ability, every individual being so different in every way, but get in the way nevertheless in your ability to be settled enough, regulated enough to interact with somebody in front of you. And so when you're able to understand those things and do something about them, then you can co-regulate. You can help somebody be a little bit more calm or appropriately attentive to the situation that is necessary. And, of course, babies who aren't having any difficulties, people who aren't having any difficulties do this naturally. And the next step in social-emotional development beyond being somewhat settled and regulated when you're an infant is falling in love with your caregiver, your parent, feeling that those moments of engagement. And from there, you get these little back-and-forth, very subtle interactions that are occurring that begin more and more to develop within the child and unconscious, really, but feel for what it's like to be connecting with somebody else. And so you can imagine there's these millions of interactions that are occurring all the time between people. And if you're cut off from those interactions, you're not learning what it's like to sort of read and respond to somebody else's cues. And so you're more dysregulated more of the time. You're cut off, and you may end up doing things that are more reliably predictable for you. And that might be flicking your fingers in front of your eyes or other kinds of perceptive kinds of thinking or behaving as you get older. So even if your language function comes in and it looks pretty good, you may end up being not very connected to the people around you and talking about your favorite things that are factual and more reliably understandable than having this feel for what the gooey, implicit, abstract stuff is that's surrounding you, but you may not really be very aware of. So this DIR model helps people, help the people they're trying to help, be regulated and then engaged in this relationship that creates and supports the back and forth flow of interaction. And that's done partly on the floor, of course, because it is floor time with DIR, but it's also something you can do with people who are higher functioning, are having trouble keeping a job, who are adults, or that we get the occasional CEO who can't keep a marriage together. There are all kinds of people on our spectrum who have all kinds of difficulties, but these same principles are at play in really every interaction. You have to be settled enough, you have to be engaged with the other person, and there has to be a productive flow of meaningful interaction that gets more and more complex and abstract, depending on how you do that. The people who provide DIR floor time type intervention include certainly mental health people, but also speech and language pathologists, occupational therapists, physical therapists, social workers, teachers, all kinds of people who've learned this. And there are two main organizations who teach this, ICDL and Profectum, and very accessible training programs through both organizations. You can go to icdl.com or profectum.org and learn about this, attend lectures online, get support for learning it. And then there are practitioners in various communities around the world who also are providing services. Like in my city, I probably have a dozen very solid DIR floor time clinicians who are seeing a lot of clients but also consulting a lot and supporting a lot of teams as other people learn about this model. If you were going to read one book about this model to try to get your hands around it, you might try The Learning Tree. That's a pretty good one. It's a short, easy read. Another one is called Engaging Autism. That's another pretty good one. I like The Learning Tree because it makes the point that this DIR floor time model encompasses ABA. It sort of includes it as part of the umbrella. A lot of people think about some sort of tension between ABA and DIR. But actually, from the point of view of DIR, there really isn't a conflict. It's more of a complementary kind of approach. And then finally, just talking about some of the research, there's been a lot of talk about, what is the research behind various kinds of autism treatments. And some of the better studies of broader interventions, DIR versus the applied behavioral analysis type interventions, are showing that the functional outcomes don't necessarily match some of the things that people learn. Like, for instance, you can teach someone to point to colors or count numbers or do some of these skills or say hello every time they meet somebody, but it doesn't necessarily help that person function in the world. In fact, if you teach someone a play sequence and they use it in a very rigid manner, other kids really don't know how to play with them anyway. So while it's helpful to know the play sequence, how do you make it more flowing and functional? The floor time part of that helps make those things more flowing and functional. So the research on ABA is complete. I mean, everybody knows that you can do randomized controlled trials of kids to teach them facts and things like that. And it was a real breakthrough by Lovaas 20 years ago to really show that kids were more teachable than people thought. And yet the more recent research shows that the active, important ingredients include this sense of emotional engagement. Connie Cassery's work at UCLA or Laura Adamson's work in Georgia really point to this. And so the research that we're doing, I'm at the ICDL grad school, we are looking at how we can bring some of those ideas of how Cassery and Adamson have shown that when You can support parents in being engaged with their kids with joint attention, how they develop better language. Well, those have been done in the lab, but we've brought it out of the lab and into the clinic, and we just put in our first paper. We hope it gets accepted by the Journal of Autism out of the UK. That is, you know, showing basically that we can teach clinicians, and we hope parents, to look at when their kids are or aren't engaged in, you know, brief video clips. And then with luck, by knowing that a little bit better, they'll be able to do it more and the kids will do better. So the research is ongoing. As I think I mentioned, the York research out of Toronto shows very clearly that this works. Research out of Michigan with Rick Solomon had suggested that a few years ago, and he's doing more research on it now. And the brain studies out of New York are showing brain changes that demonstrate normalization, partial normalization of the cortical structures in kids who get this kind of approach. So it's certainly something that's been long in coming in terms of being able to study these, because it's a lot harder to study DIR than it is to study ABA, a lot of ABA approaches. But I think it's going to be kind of the new wave over the next decade or two in the approach to people with autism and related disorders. Does that help?
Yes. I wanted to thank you for emphasizing that, things can be treatments can be complementary to each other, and not necessarily you have to pick one or the other, because we've done just about everything with our son, sometimes at the same time. And I just think parents sometimes get polarized into thinking that it's either this or that, but treatments can be, complementary to each other.
I agree. I think it's a real problem when you see large organizations pressing for one kind of treatment, for instance, for insurance to provide treatment for one, or coverage for one kind of treatment, mm-hmm. when leading out a lot of other treatments, particularly evidence-based practices, mainly because it defies the literature, the research, and it also defies the principle of families choosing what's best for their kids. Now, on the one hand, society does step in when families choose certain ways for their kids that might be grossly negligent or, you know, dangerous or something like that, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about, how do you get a fit of a treatment with a family? Families are all different, and they have different ways of learning, communicating, and if you're trying to buck that culture, you're not going to get very far. So how do you fit, how do you honor and respect the family and work with them to support them in supporting their child? To me, that's the most important principle at play.
Very true. And as we wrap it up here today, I wanted to ask you, I would be remiss if I did not ask you as a doctor, what you felt about the rise in the numbers, the prevalence.
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, the 1 in 88 study is pretty interesting, huh? That is 1 in 54 guys. I guess I'm not that surprised. I think as we look for it more, we see the spectrum and we see how it fits within our general everyday life. Temple Grandin says it best, right? If it weren't for people on the spectrum, all the quote-unquote neurotypicals would still be, you know, yammering at each other in caves. I think it's really helpful to appreciate and respect the place of the spectrum within our broader society. It's an integral and necessary part of our world to have people on the spectrum as part of it. And, yeah, there are people who have more significant challenges that we're trying to help with toileting and feeding and communicating. Similarly, there's a range of people, like I said, with borderline personality disorder who we're trying to help keep alive and settle down and, things like that. So, of course, within any spectrum of difficulty, you're going to have a number of people who are very prominently symptomatic at one end, but it's important to appreciate the pieces of those syndromes that are at play in individuals who are having difficulty, even if it isn't as obvious, and for whom you can give them some assistance and they can do better. Now, that said, I'm a big fan of Eric Corshane, who you may know as one of the lead researchers in the world, and he happens to be a colleague here in San Diego looking at brain research and things like that in autism. And he alerted me to the growing literature studying older people, people in their 70s, and using the same broad criteria that we've been using with the younger kids. What many researchers are finding are numbers that are similar to the numbers that we're finding in the young kids. So, for instance, like 1 in 100-ish type prevalence. So when we talk about an epidemic of autism, I'm one of those people who's, you know, pretty sure that there are environmental components that go into the creation. So some is hereditary genetics.